The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One photo at a time. This is Aaron McCrady.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Hope you're having a great day. I've got a great show for you today. But before we get to all that, we will be having on the air Thursday at 8 o'clock p.m. Cecil Murphy. He's a New York Times best-selling author, and you may have heard of the book 90 Minutes in Heaven. He authored that, and his latest book is When a Man You Love Was Abused. That is coming up Thursday at 8 o'clock. But I'd like to introduce my guest today. My guest today is Dr. Jack Caravelli, and he started his governmental career at the CIA in 1982, and then he moved to the White House National Security Council, and he was on that staff from 1996 to 2000, where as a senior career official, he was responsible for the U.S. nonproliferation policy in the Middle East and Russia, and he then became a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy from 2000 to 2005. Directing the department's International Threat Reduction Program, and he has a new book, or his most recent book, rather, Beyond Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East. Welcome to the show.
Aaron, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How are you doing today?
Well, I'm fine. We have a beautiful day in Washington, and I look forward to our conversation.
Oh, me too. What in your book do you exactly mean, Beyond Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East?
Well, I think most of us, certainly those of us who live in the United States, sort of look at the Middle East often as sort of this one amorphous large group of nations that mostly are characterized sort of two-dimensionally as, again, sand and oil, sort of the two things that are in abundance in the Middle East. But, you know, underlying that has been a deeper and darker reality of nuclear programs throughout the region. And I wanted to try to sort of tell that story in a way that would, I think, interest both lay readers and experts alike, and use my experience both in the intelligence side of the United States government as well as on the policy side to try to draw out some of the meanings of the events that we've watched, all of this, in the past 20, 25 years.
Right. And where can they go to get your book?
Well, it's on Amazon, like most things these days. And some of the big bookshops carry it as well, but thank you for asking that, and the easiest way is to go on Amazon.
Well, good, good. And one question I did have, and I came across an article, and I believe it was this past week, that Israel's military chief said that he does not believe that Iran will decide to build an atomic bomb or nuclear weapon, but then, of course, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu disagrees with that. Who's right on that?
Well, it is, I think, is what you're saying here. It is a very difficult issue that is hard to answer for anyone with any precision, no matter what their job title or status in government. I think the best way to get an answer is really to look not at what Iran says, but what Iran does. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at the evidentiary base there, Aaron, you see in Iran that, and I think this is telling, a nation that has committed resources, you know, to its programs, both nuclear and missile, since really the mid-1980s. And I think every nation votes with its resources. And in Iran's case, no matter how good or bad the economy, those programs have moved forward. They've had problems from time to time. But I think that, you know, as the political leader of Israel, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu carries a unique experience and unique responsibility to safeguard, you know, Israel's well-being to the extent that he can, in a way that even, you know, his military and intelligence chiefs, you know, can't know. I think he's being very prudent. But again, I think that given what we've seen from Iran's programs, what we heard from Iran's leaders, you know, the prime minister, sadly, may be on the right track. But again, the key here is we do not know for sure. Anyone that says they do on either side of the debate is probably fooling themselves and their audience.
Right. the leadership in Iran, they said that if they do develop that, or while they're developing it for peaceful purposes. I mean, are they being disingenuous when they say that?
Well, I think they are being disingenuous. Look, the Iran has been producing, again, for quite some time, large amounts of enriched uranium. Now, enriched uranium at low levels is exactly what you would use for a commercial nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. and that's all fine. The only problem is, in Iran's case, they have no commercial nuclear power plants except the one that is coming online at a facility called Bushehr, and in that case, Russia has agreed to provide the fuel. So I think it's sort of an imperfect analogy, but what I would offer to you and your audience is this, as an analogy. A nation, in Iran's case, that is building the capacity, for example, to make gasoline, to provide refineries, but it doesn't have any cars to use. Hmm. And that is essentially what Iran is doing with its nuclear program. It is producing all this fuel, but it has no commercial outlet in which to use it. So, you know, that's a fact that is often sort of ignored by the naysayers. But I think, again, we look closely at Iran's behavior, and I think we certainly seem to see enough evidence that, you know, their words and actions just don't mix.
Well, you spent, you know, many years at the CIA, and then you went worked in the White House with the National Security Council, and so you probably know, you know, more than anybody, you know, what is going on behind the scenes, and you probably know so much that it would keep all of us up at night. But what do you think, or what steps would the Obama administration be taking right now behind the scenes to ensure that Iran doesn't produce that for reasons that that, you know, aren't too great for the rest of us?
Well, I think basically, Aaron, we have seen the most of the output, if you will, of the administration's policy. They have obviously been supportive of diplomacy, and they have been supportive of increased sanctions on Iran. Again, as we sit here at the end of April in 2012, I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, have the policies worked? And again, the gold standard, if you will, for any policy along these lines is simply, does it change or alter Iran's behavior? Mm-hmm. And to this point, I think, again, unfortunately, the only, you know, honest answer is it has not. It has, in one respect, brought Iran back to the negotiating table. A second round of negotiations with Iran will take place about the 23rd of May. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, it will provide some substance. But beyond that, again, recent visits by the UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, those visits twice were stonewalled in that request by the IAEA to visit or access Iranian facilities, which they're entitled to do because Iran is a non-proliferation treaty member. Mm-hmm. IAEA requests to talk to Iranian scientists. Both of these requests on two separate occasions recently have been flat out denied by Iran. So, again, Iran would like us to believe it has, as you said at the start, peaceful intentions only with its nuclear work. But, again, there is this growing mountain of evidence that points in a different direction.
Now, you know, this is just an outsider looking in, but, you know, it seems to me with what Iran is up to, the things that they're saying, you know, they're not allowing people to come in, that almost to me seems like it's more reminiscent of what Saddam Hussein did in Iraq. Is that similar, or am I off base there?
Well, it is not a bad analogy. Yet in the and I write about this in the book, the chapter on Iraq, you know, during the 80s and 90s, you know, again, in the Iraqi case, Hussein, you know, clearly had the aspirations to try to walk down a nuclear path. But again, there's a difference between aspiration and capability. He didn't get there. But after the, as you recall, you know, our successful defense of Kuwait and sort of throwing the Iraqi military out of Kuwait was followed by extensive inspections by the United Nations mm-hmm. in Iraq of different facilities, and that I think basically showed that, among other things, that Hussein was trying to play a shell game, clearly with the IAEA and the inspectors, and I detail that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, your question is it's a good analogy, because clearly there is a cat and mouse or a shell game that has been played by the Iranian government literally for years with the international community.
Right. If you're just joining the show, we are talking to Dr. Jack Caravelli, and the call number is 646-200-3400. But getting back to you know what we're talking about, one thing that really concerns me with, you know, with Iraq and then, you know, what happened with Iraq and then Iran is, you know, back before we went back into Iraq, you know, Congress, the president, everyone had the same intelligence, and everyone believed that Iraq had the weapons that we went in there for, but when we went in, we didn't really find a whole lot. If we had to go into Iran, what are the chances that our intelligence is just, you know, wrong like it was in Iraq, and then, you know, we have egg on our face again?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and one that's debated, I know, often in this city where I live. I think the short answer is the intelligence community, you know, has devoted enormous resources literally for decades now to following Iran and its program. And those sources, as you know, are varied, and we don't have to go into the particulars. But I think what we can say is that we do know, I think, as a fact, again, through all these years of watching a great deal of Iran's programs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we know everything? No. There were clearly critical gaps in our understanding, and it's those critical gaps, I think, that leads, you know, our friends in Israel to, again, the different conclusions that we were talking about earlier. But I think in the main, what we can say with very high confidence is that Iran has pursued the three critical dimensions or paths, if you will, toward a nuclear weapons capability. And the first of those is really acquiring the material that could be used to make an atomic weapon. The second is trying to do the research and development to take that material and turn it into a warhead that would fit atop a missile. And the third, and again, there are some who overlook this, and the third part is, again, Iran's long commitment of resources to developing the missile capability to deliver a weapon to target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a conversation that doesn't matter if you can't deliver the weapon to target. But in Iran's case, you know, we know, again, for a fact that they have developed for what they call a Shahab-3 missile, the capability to today launch weapons toward targets, you know, throughout the region. And in that combination of program elements, I think really points to Iran's intention to try to acquire a capability that would be very destabilizing and certainly threatening to our friends and allies.
Right, and you know, one thing that I think differentiates Hussein and then the leaders over in Iran is, you know, Iran, they come over here to the United Nations on United States soil. Granted, it's the United Nations, but, you know, and just make a mockery of the United States inside our country. And, you know, that right there tells me that, you know, if they are brazen enough to do that on our own soil, then, you know, why wouldn't they have the weapons over there?
Well, you know, I take the point very well. And the, you know, the Iranian president really has been one, both in America and in his various travels around the world, that has been very provocative, confrontational, and aggressive. And, you know, certainly in terms of the, you know, the great support and respect I have for our friends in Israel, you know, you can't ignore that kind of rhetoric, which is reprehensible, and not be very, very concerned about what Iran would like to do.
Right.
And I fully understand the deep Israeli angst about this. I think what I would add to our discussion a moment ago is simply that in the case of perhaps some differences in Israel about what to do, about what the cure is for the disease, if you will, I think there's really no distance or disagreement between anyone and any part of the Israeli political or military establishment, you know, about the kind of, you know, deep and abiding threat that Iran, you know, may pose, you know, if it chooses to cross, you know, the nuclear threshold.
Right. You know, you had spoken about Russia earlier, but Russia, to me, comes across, tries to come across as a friend to the United States and almost as an ally, but I feel like, though, that they're actively working against U.S., I don't know what I want to say, interests, I guess. For example, with Syria, they're supplying fuel to Syria, and mm-hmm. Iran is supplying fuel to Syria through Iraq, I believe.
That's correct. Yes, correct.
Am I wrong in assuming that Russia is actually an enemy rather than an ally?
Well, I wouldn't call them an enemy, I think, Aaron. I think the, you know, the relationship we have with Russia in this case can be as good or as bad as they want it to be. As you know, the Vladimir Putin is returning within about a week or two to the presidency of Russia. Putin, I think, by any standard, is a Russian nationalist, and I think he will certainly try to pursue Russia's interests aggressively, particularly in the Middle East. Russia cares about that a lot. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say they're an enemy, but I would say that they're an adversary, and mm-hmm. they're certainly trying to advance their interests. And I think in Putin's particular case, I think there's a lot of evidence from his, you know, first 8 years as Russian president that he certainly views the United States as an adversary.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be very interesting, you know, to see just, you know, what balance, you know, now as president again, he will strike between advancing Russia's interests and, you know, how he sort of lines up, you know, U.S. support the U.S. relationship as, you know, as part of that. But I think at the very least, you know, we need to have open eyes dealing with Russia. And, you know, there are things perhaps this administration wants to achieve, and it's not clear to me that they will be able to do those things with Vladimir Putin back as president.
Right. If by chance Israel does go into Iran, starts attacking Iran, are they going to pull the United States along with us, or will this administration, and I make no bones about it, you know, I'm not a fan of this administration, will the administration just sit by the wayside and just let Israel, you know, either succeed or just be devastated?
Well, your question is probably one of Barack Obama's nightmares. I think I would be very reluctant to hazard any kind of answer to your question, except to say that, you know, the Obama administration, you know, has said that it is, quote unquote, unacceptable for Iran to become a nuclear weapon state. Now, what
mm-hmm.
does, you know, and that all options are on the table. Now, will the administration be good to its word? I think the very last thing this administration wants to do is commit any kind of military resources to any kind of undertaking against Iran. Now,
right.
where does that leave us if Israel chooses to attack? I think obviously a very difficult place, and I would not put money on the administration backing Israel militarily. Perhaps there would be some intelligence support or some logistics support. And I think the Israelis certainly understand this, and I think part of the, if you will, hesitation on Israel's part has been just doing the calculus to the question you've just posed about what would the United States do. I do not know if there's any clear understanding quietly between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a terribly difficult situation, and given the special relationship the United States has with Israel, particularly the relationship between the Democratic Party
right.
and our country and Israel, I think it becomes a again, one of the president's worst nightmares of a decision that he would have to take. I think what becomes most important is what kind of region and stability do we want in the Middle East? And if Israel, chooses to go in, I think the Americans would, leaving aside whatever administration it is, but the administration would have to look very closely at how much support we could provide.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned Syria earlier, and to me, if I was president, I would have either sent support over to Syria on behalf of, the citizens of Syria. But if we were to have done that, would that almost be like we're going at war with Russia and with Iran right there because they are supplying oil and fuel to Syria?
Well, you've posed an awfully good question. It is, again, one of the great lessons I learned from my service in the White House was simply that there's no single issue. Every issue you look at brings the kind of, strings attached that you mentioned. I think in the case of Syria, it is appalling that the international community is basically standing by and watching Syria murder its own people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a morally indefensible position,
right,
both for the United States and others. Even the Arab League has been really critical of Syria, and I think that more concrete actions need to be taken, at the very least, to maybe train and arm the Syrian resistance forces. Now, I think it's pretty clear that if the Obama administration, which is obviously still very tied up in Afghanistan, if it was not prepared to use its military assets in Libya, which is probably a much easier and cleaner situations than what you described, given the interest of Russia and Iran around Syria, I think it is highly unlikely that this administration would commit any kind of direct military assets, to defend Syria. And I think in part because of the situation you described, but also in part because this administration perceives, I think, the American public as just not being willing to tolerate, particularly in an election year, another set of hostilities.
Do you think that we're? It seems like, to me, afraid to help Israel because we're afraid of Iran. We're not going to Syria. Is the administration, and I'm not talking about the people that work with and for the president, but is the president incompetent?
I don't think he's incompetent. I think he, I think his approach is to sort of maybe the lawyerly training he had when he was younger, to gather evidence. Sometimes it is slow, to be as thoughtful as he can. But I think I'm not so troubled by the process that the president applies, but, certainly in some cases, such as Syria or Iran, I think there were probably more timely and aggressive actions, that Washington could have taken that again, they've made a conscious decision not to take.
Right. I want to skip over to Pakistan for a moment. And we sent a U.S. envoy over to Pakistan.
Yes.
For, questions if we should issue a formal apology for an airstrike that killed 24 of their soldiers. But why would the United States be in such a situation that we would have to send an envoy over there to see if we should have a formal apology?
Well, it was, of course, a very unfortunate act that the NATO airstrike did kill 24 Pakistanis. There's some murky details about it. The intent of the visit from Mark Grossman just recently, a few days ago, was, I think, as you know, Aaron, the talks broke down. The United States did not issue an apology. The reason, I think in large measure, stems from the fact that the United States government, and I think rightly so, is extremely concerned, as well it should be, about the almost certain support of the Pakistani intelligence service called the ISI in supporting in one fashion or another, the attack in Afghanistan in mid-April by the what is called the Haqqani Network, where they attacked Kabul as well as three other cities in Afghanistan. And again, the fact that these insurgents continue to destabilize Afghanistan, kill American troops, and cause us to commit lives and treasure to that war, it certainly can be traced back in large measure, again, to at least one element of the Pakistani government supporting the insurgents.
Right.
And that is just, it's appalling, it's ridiculous, and it's unacceptable. And I am, frankly, pleased that the American government chose not to issue an apology because of its, again, its clear concern, again, that's justified about where Pakistan is and sort of the two faces it shows to the war on terrorism. One claiming support to the war, and the other, where at least one of its most important security elements is actually supporting the extremists.
Right.
And again, the United States and the people of Afghanistan are both, caught up in this, extraordinarily complex situation.
Now, Pakistan, they want a formal apology, from the United States for killing 24 of their soldiers. Why don't we, demand an apology from them for hiding Osama bin Laden?
Well, I think there have been a lot of discussions sort of behind the scenes that have taken place. And again, it really does not pass the laugh test, for the Pakistani government or the Pakistani military intelligence services, to say that they didn't know about bin Laden's whereabouts, mm-hmm. literally for years, a mile away from the military academy. Again, it just makes no sense. Pakistan has been the recipient over the past decade of about $20 billion of our taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
Much of that has gone to the military. And again, what we have received in return from Pakistan for that $20 billion investment, to be honest, has been limited at best in its return. So it's really not been a good investment. The core of the problem with Pakistan is not hard to find. And that core problem is simply that the civilian government is weak, and it is really beholden. It's almost as I would describe as an inverted pyramid. That government is beholden to the military and intelligence services. Now, as in democracies, civilians run governments, and military and intelligence services, respond and take direction from the civilian authorities.
Mm-hmm.
In Pakistan's case, the situation is reversed. Ever since Pakistan became a nation in 1948, the civilian governments have been very weak. The military and intelligence services, have dominated the government. They've overthrown civilian governments. And again, we're seeing the same old story play out in Pakistan, where the civilian government, once again, is very weak, and it's really unable or unwilling to try to control its military and intelligence arms. And as long as that core problem persists, Iran will remain an extremely dangerous place, in part because it is a nuclear weapon state. So it is almost a perfect storm of political problems that both the Bush administration and now the Obama administration have really struggled, to sort of get their arms around, and, quite frankly, neither has been terribly successful in doing so.
Right. Why won't the Obama administration release the pictures of the bin Laden raid and his ultimate death?
Well, I don't know. It's a great question. I assume, and that's all it is, I guess that it's because they would find it potentially troubling, or perhaps be a cause celeb of more destabilization in that part of the world, maybe to bin Laden would become sort of more of a martyr in the eyes of some. But,
mm-hmm.
This is all speculation that really is best directed at the White House press secretary.
Right. Well, one last question I have, and then I will let you go. You've been good for coming on the show. But, you know, people have said before, and you've worked in the White House and, you know, beside Bill Clinton, did Clinton have bin Laden in his sights, but he decided not to take bin Laden out?
I don't know, Aaron. I think if it's a right phrase to say he had him in his sights, but I guess the data point I would leave with you, and I thank you for the opportunity to share these thoughts with your listeners, is simply that when the Clinton administration was leaving office, the National Security Advisor at the time, Sandy Berger, told Condoleezza Rice, as she was coming into office, as you know, first the National Security Advisor to George Bush, Berger reportedly told Condoleezza Rice that, you know, her biggest worry and her biggest problem on the foreign policy agenda by far would be the threat posed by extremists led by bin Laden. Mm-hmm. So I think at the very least, I think the record shows that there was at least a warning coming from the Clinton administration, and whether they had an opportunity to take more direct action at the end of their watch against bin Laden, you know, to be honest, I am not sure.
Right. Well, I really do appreciate you coming on the show. And his book, Beyond Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East, Dr. Jack Caravelli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Aaron, it has been a pleasure, and I would also share with your listeners that they may be quite interested in some of the work I've been doing with some colleagues from CIA and elsewhere on a website called Lignet, LIGNET.com, which offers a $1 a month for the first month trial subscription. And when they sign up for that trial subscription, they also get a copy of the CIA fact book, which will at least share some of the insights and information that you know, we draw upon in making that website work on a daily basis.
You know, you mentioned that, and I actually signed up for that last night and went on there and started reading some of the articles, and it really is like that you're almost getting classified briefings every single day, so it really gets you up to speed on what's happening in the world.
Well, I thank you for that. I have enjoyed working with some very good and talented colleagues who are very steeped in regions, not only the things I write on, as we discussed, Russia and the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also some excellent colleagues who follow Asia, who follow Latin America, South America. So we, as well as economic issues, such as in, you know, the Euro crisis in Europe. Mm-hmm. So we are proud of this. We have been well supported by Chris Ruddy and Newsmax, which is a very good publication or online publication in its own right. So we're standing up what I think is going to be really a first-class operation, and one where we, you know, try to strip the ideology away from the issues, but really apply the experience and analytic judgments, you know, the writers learned through our time at the CIA, to try to provide an unclassified look at the world, again, through the eyes of experienced analysts.
Right. Well, again, that site is Lignet, LIGNET.com. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate your time.
Aaron, it's been a pleasure, and have a good day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Jack Caravelli. He's got the book out, Beyond Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East, and he was a aide to President Bill Clinton when Clinton was in the White House, and he was part of the National Security Council staff from 1996 to 2000, where he was responsible for the U.S. non-proliferation policy in the Middle East and Russia. Then after that, he became Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy from 2000 to 2005, of course, under the George W. Bush administration, directing the Department's International Threat Reduction Programs. We are going to take a news break, and we will be right back.
News Radio. I'm Lisa LaSierra. A day at the zoo turns tragic in the Bronx section of New York City. Fox Radio's Jeff Bonasso with more live.
Lisa, the New York City Fire Department tells Fox News a van bounced off a median near the Bronx Zoo and plowed through the guardrails of an overpass, plunging. over 100 feet and landing in a rail yard bordering that Bronx zoo, killing all seven people inside the van, including three children. We don't know right now what caused the crash, Lisa, but authorities tell us the passengers in the van did not stand a chance.
Jeff, as we approach 1 year since the raid on Osama bin Laden's hideout in Pakistan that killed the terror leader, counterterrorism officials say Al-Qaeda dreams of payback.
President Obama's chief counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, said today there is no credible threat of an attack on our homeland by a terrorist trying to mark the first anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death with violence. Brennan also said over the last decade, Al-Qaeda has been degraded as an organization, but that their affiliate in Yemen continues to cause concern. He was asked about whether or not it's appropriate for the Obama campaign to highlight the bin Laden raid in a new ad at one point, and he said he doesn't do politics.
Fox's Peter Doocy in Washington. Britain's foreign secretary condemning the killing of a British Red Cross worker kidnapped in Pakistan in January. New leads in the case of a six-year-old girl from Tucson, Arizona, who has been missing for over a week.
Officers say at least one male has come forward, identifying himself as being on the video that was taken about 1:30 in the morning the day Isabel was reported missing from her bedroom by her father, April the 21st.
Fox's Anna Koyman. A new report says Apple uses subsidiaries in Ireland, the Netherlands, and other low-tax nations as part of a strategy to cut its global tax bill by billions of dollars every year. According to the New York Times, the company uses eight methods, all legal. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Stay connected to Fox News Radio for your favorite talk shows, newscasts on the hour and half hour, and the podcasts that take you a step deeper inside of Fox News. Don't miss a single minute of Your World with Neil Cavuto daily by subscribing to the Daily Podcast.
I'm Neil Cavuto.
Get news and insight on Wall Street and other market activities, and get a wrap-up of the business news of the day.
Don't tell me about federal programs that stick to their budget. They don't.
It's Cavuto, when you want it, and where you want it. Subscribe now by going to foxnewsradio.com and click on the podcast button for Your World with Neil Cavuto. And check out other Fox News Radio podcasts, including John Gibson's My Word.
Hi, I'm John Gibson. You can get My Word every day for no holds barred opinion on the big stories of the day. Gibson, when and where you want at foxnewsradio.com. Just click on the podcast button.
The Coast Guard continues to search for a fourth victim of a crash during a yacht race off the California coast.
Three people dead, a fourth still missing after a yacht named the Aegean ran into trouble, apparently colliding with a much larger vessel. The boat was participating in a race off the coast of California and Mexico. The U.S. Coast Guard's Henry Dumphy says the accident occurred well into the race near Mexico's Coronado Islands.
The Coronado Islands are approximately 10 miles offshore, and they're, you know, between Tijuana and Rosarito on the Mexican coast there, so I'd say they're about halfway, a little bit more than halfway.
The accident comes 2 weeks after five sailors died in a race off Northern California when their yacht was hit by powerful waves and smashed into rocks. Pat O'Neill, Fox News Radio.
Sales of storm shelters skyrocketing across the middle of the country, especially in cities hit hard last year by tornadoes. Some states offering grants to help people pay for the added protection. If reports about an escaped dissident are true, they could complicate a trip to China this week for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner.
Chen Guangcheng, a blind lawyer put under house arrest for fighting against forced abortions and sterilizations in China, friends say he's escaped and is now under the protection of American diplomats. White House advisor John Brennan not confirming that, saying, though, international relations are a balance.
I think in all instances, the president tries to balance our commitment to human rights, making sure that the people throughout the world have the ability to express themselves freely and openly, but also that we can continue to carry out our relationships with key countries overseas.
Brennan on Fox News Sunday, Mitt Romney releasing a statement saying that our government should do everything it can to protect this activist and confront the facts about China's one-child policy. Chris Foster, Fox News Radio.
The director of the next James Bond film saying he's been inspired by the conflicted character of the British spy as depicted in the original novels by Ian Fleming and plans to use that in the next film, Skyfall. Lisa Lucero, Fox News Radio.
A colorless landscape. The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One vote. total at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule. That government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people. But if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? We're not, as some would have us believe, doomed to an inevitable decline. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed. Can we solve the problems confronting us? Well, the answer is an unequivocal and emphatic yes. And after all, why shouldn't we believe that? We are Americans.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. If you've missed the first half of the show, you've missed Dr. Jack Caravelli. He worked for Bill Clinton during the Clinton administration in the White House, and then went on under the George W. Bush administration to do some work as well. But now he is with Lignet.com, Lignet.com. And he also is an author of a book called Beyond Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East. And if you're brand new to the show, as you know, the second half of the show we devote to presidential politics and the presidential election and how we can help defeat Barack Obama. We absolutely have to get him out of the White House. He has just been a devastating force to our country. And as you heard, you know, my conversation with Jack Caravelli, you know, he would not say it, but, you know, some of the things you could just tell that he was disappointed in the Obama administration, especially with the reaction to Syria and then also the reaction, to Iran and Israel. But I do want to play one clip for you here, then we're going to talk about it. We are coming up on the one-year anniversary of the bin Laden raid, where we did capture and kill Osama bin Laden. I want to play this clip for you. The Obama administration just released an ad, and Bill Clinton is narrating the ad, and is talking about, pretty much talking about Romney, how Romney, would not have the guts or the courage to have taken out bin Laden. And this is what Bill Clinton says about Obama and what the Obama administration wants you to hear. And then we're going to talk about this right after you listen to this.
This would be easier if I could...
Actually, you know what? That's the wrong clip. I am sorry about that. But here is the new Obama ad right here.
That's one thing George Bush said that was right. The president is the decider-in-chief. Nobody can make that decision for you. Look, he knew what would happen. Suppose the Navy SEALs had gone in there and it hadn't been bin Laden. Suppose they'd been captured or killed. The downside would have been horrible for him. But he reasoned. I cannot in good conscience do nothing. He took the harder and the more honorable path. And the one that produced, in my opinion, the best result.
It's not worth moving heaven and earth, spending billions of dollars just trying to catch one person. He was referring to the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. What did he mean by that? Because it's generated a little controversy, given Osama bin Laden's role in killing, 3,000 Americans on 9/11.
He had to decide. And that's what you hire a president to do. You hire the president to make the calls when no one else can do it.
You know, first of all, I have a few issues with this ad. First, it's narrated by Bill Clinton. And you heard the last question I asked Jack Caravelli is if Clinton had him in his sights. Jack Caravelli was in the White House at that time, and he said that he, you know, you know, that would be the wrong term to say having them in his sights. But the Clinton administration did warn the Bush administration about bin Laden. And you know what? Reports have surfaced, back when this happened with 9/11, that Clinton did have him in his sights. And you know what? That takes a lot of gall of someone that had bin Laden at your fingertips and you decided not to do anything about it, and then to go on and say that Barack Obama had the courage. Well, I would like somebody to call in 646-200-3400 and someone please exactly tell me what person on this earth, if they were president of the United States, when the military and CIA, FBI, everyone that was involved in tracking down bin Laden, they come to you and say, we know where bin Laden is, we think he's in this building, would you like us to take him out? Who would say no? And you know what? If it did go wrong, if the raid did go wrong, I don't think the American people would hold the president accountable for that. And I'll tell you why. Because we were actually trying to do something. We were actually trying to take out bin Laden. So for the former president to go on there and sing Obama's praises, and I understand that President Clinton's wife, Hillary Clinton, worked for Obama, but to go and say that is a little bit disingenuous on the former president's part. It's actually just sickening. You know, it's all about politics for him. It's all about advancing himself or Hillary. Doesn't matter what the facts are. And then the last word he says, the last sentence he says, is that you hire a president to make the decisions. Well, you know what? We also hired Barack Obama to get us out of this recession, to create jobs. Has Barack Obama created jobs? You know, he told us that if we passed this stimulus when he came into the White House, that unemployment would not go over 8%. Well, it went over 10%. Now it's only back down to 8. You know, net total, he hasn't created a single job. That's what we hired him for. Change you can believe in. Shame on us for not asking Barack Obama or the media reporting exactly what change that would be. Because I think it's been changed for the worst. You know, we don't stick up to our friends in Israel. We have Iran building a nuclear weapon. And we have Mr. Lily-livered chicken president in the White House right now, Barack Obama. Won't do anything about it. We have Syria murdering their own people. What happened to the day that the United States stood up for something? When did the United States become so morally corrupt that we cannot take up for the people of Syria when their own government is murdering them? Granted, it is on a much, much smaller scale, but somebody tell me, please, what the difference is between Syria murdering and killing their own people and then the Holocaust. Someone tell me what the difference is. You're still murdering people. And what is the United States doing? Oh, absolutely nothing, because we're scared to death of Russia. We're scared to death of Iran, because Iran and Russia is supplying fuel over to Syria. But then you have, Mr. Mighty President, since he's taken office, been on over 155 golf outings. You know, it just drives me crazy. I don't understand it. That's why we need a new president. And you know what? Everybody talks about free health care, how we've got Obamacare coming now. I'm going to be able to get free health care. Well, let me tell you something. A lot of you, I'm sure, are unaware of this, but that's what you're listening to me for. I'm going to let you know. The Heritage Foundation, go to their website. The Heritage Foundation reports, and I've looked into this, and this is absolutely true, and they call it Taxmageddon. On January 1st, 2013, this coming January 1st, Americans are going to face a $494 billion tax increase, and that's billion with a B, the highest ever in 1 year. And guess what we're going to do with that $494 billion tax increase, which it equals out roughly to $3,800 more per household in America. Now, that's an average. Some will pay more, some will pay less, but that's an average of $3,800 more. It's going to help pay for Obamacare. So all you people out there that thought, oh, I'm getting free health care, huh? $3,800. $3,800. Maybe you'll realize now that the government does not have money of its own. It comes from the people. It comes from me. It comes from you. It comes from your neighbor. It comes from your coworker. It's your money. You are paying $3,800 into Obamacare for your health care. You know, the Obamacare, also, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. They have an anti-conscience mandate. Under Obamacare, all insurance plans must cover at no charge. Now, they're misleading here, at no charge. It's going to cost you $3,800. Abortion-inducing drugs, contraceptives, sterilization, patient education and counseling for women of reproductive age. And then we know that religious employers such as Catholic hospitals, Christian schools, faith-based pregnancy care centers will have to provide and pay for those coverage of their employees, regardless of their religious beliefs. So, if you're a Catholic and you work for a Catholic hospital or you're involved in the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, if they have you as an employee, they've got to pay for abortion-inducing drugs if you want them, contraceptives, sterilization. What sense does that make? That goes against the Catholic Church's beliefs. But you know what? President Obama, on February 10th, he had a press conference, and he announced an accommodation. But it did not actually change the policy. In fact, the final rule that was filed later that day was the exact same wording and legislation that he mandated under Obamacare. That's our president for you. That's who we voted into office 4 years ago. You know, and we do need Medicare reform, but we don't need Obamacare. You know, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she said that the health care law protects Medicare, but the truth is that Obamacare makes massive changes to the program. Obamacare, it contains more than 160 provisions for Medicare that increases the government's control over delivery of the care, and then it also hits doctors with unsustainable payment cuts, and it leaves taxpayers with higher deficits. So, you know, what do you think what's going to happen to the medical industry? The people that want to provide excellent care for me, for you, for everyone, they're not going to be able to afford to go into the medical practice because government wants control over the delivery of care, and they're going to have reimbursement rates that is a lot less than the cost of services. But you know what? What would you expect, though, from a government that in 2010 we collected $2.2 trillion in total tax revenue? So we had $2.2 trillion coming in to the government from the taxpayers, from me and from you. But you know what the government did? They spent $3.5 trillion. That's $1.3 trillion with a T, trillion dollars, that they went into the hole. Now, what if you spent that? And overdrew your checking account continuously. What if you ran a business and you kept spending a lot more than you were making? What would happen? You wouldn't be in business very long. So why should we allow the government to do that also? But that's the same old dance. That's the same old story with the Obama administration. And then also education. education in this country has just went down the tubes. But when have you heard the administration talk about education? Just listen to this clip right here. I want you to listen to it.
In 2009, the U.S. took home over 75 medals in athletic competitions. Today, our students rank 25th in the world in math. There's no medal for that. Let's get America back on track. The more we invest in teachers, the better our students will perform. Let's solve this.
You know, 25th in math. That's out of 30 countries. We're fifth from the bottom in math. Out of over 100 countries, we're 48th in literacy. What's the future of our country going to look like when we can't even, you know, be the top performers in education? But has the administration done anything about education? They're concerned about taking your rights away in healthcare. You know, they're concerned about that, but not educating the future of the country, because all they see is the here and now. All they see is the here and now. When they have to work, especially Congress, when Congress has to work, they complain. If they have to work 12-hour days for a week at a time, they complain. If they have to work over the weekends, they complain. Have you heard this from Harry Reid? When they had to work because they cut it close to a deadline and they had to work day in and day out. Listen to this.
And this has been a pretty hard work period we've had. Last two weekends and working late. And I think the Senate deserves to be able to go home as soon as we can. If there are ever a time when we need to work with our constituents, it's now. And for me personally, I've been here for a long time. I have a home in Nevada that I haven't seen in months. My pomegranate trees are, I'm told, blossoming, and some pomegranates on them. I have some fig trees and roses and stuff that I just haven't seen. So I have constituents that I'm anxious to see, friends I need to visit with, relatives I need to visit with. So as soon as we can complete our work.
You know what? I'm going to cut that off. I'm so sick of him. You know what, Harry Reid? If you don't want to do your job, if you want to sit and look at your figs and your pomegranates, then why don't you just retire? Do everybody a favor. The state of Nevada, the people of Nevada, rather, hired you to go do a job. And if you have to complain about that job and you're paid very well for it, you're paid very well for not doing a whole lot, for not getting to see your pomegranate trees and your figs. If that's what the Democratic Party thinks, if that's how the mentality of the Democratic Party, then we're in a sad, sad state. A sad, sad state. And we will, and there's people out there that want to reelect these people, that want Obama to go back in the White House, that want the Democrats to still remain in power. What exactly have they done? Obama had a majority of Congress and the majority of this during the first 2 years of his administration. What did he get accomplished? Not a whole lot. You know, but you know, I know that things are tough right now in this country, and that there's a lot of people out of work. But as we end the show today, if you're out of a job, I don't want you to be down. You do have a job. Your new job is to spend those 40 hours, those 50, those 60 hours a week finding a new job, because America isn't a nation of quitters, and you don't need to be a quitter. You need to go out there and do whatever it takes to find a job. Maybe you have to take a job that doesn't exactly represent your experiences, but at least you have a job and you're bringing in some type of money. Also, don't take my word for it. Don't take other people's word for it. The news, other talk show hosts on the Obama administration or the Republican Party or who's good, who's bad. Go do research yourself. But the best thing you can do is do research and make your own decision. Join us back here on Thursday. We're going to have a special guest then also, Thursday at 8 o'clock. It's been a great pleasure and privilege to be with you. And I thank Dr. Jack Caravelli for being on the show. Have a great day.